Coming up on Boston Public Radio, is this cool or what? That's straight out of the governor's mouth about the MBTA's new late-night service. New York City, watch out. Secretary Rich Davey will give us the lowdown on how the MBTA plans to pull off working the wee hours. And from there, we check in with Boston Globe editor Brian McGorry. Can you imagine a world where the paperboy is replaced by delivery drones? And we'll also talk about the vote this afternoon by the Boston City Council on the police contract.
Tufts University professor Peniel Joseph on the incredibly high rates for incarceration for young black men. Is this an effort to undo civil rights laws? And then new music with the Globe's Sarah Rodman. And straight from the Curiosity Desk, our own Edgar B. Hoerig III. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Brownie, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hello there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
Is this cool or what? I love that. That's what Governor Deval Patrick said about the MBTA literally and figuratively burning the midnight oil. I'm sure you've read, as of next spring, Boston will be on its way to becoming a 24-hour city. The T will run trains and the most popular bus routes until 3 a.m. on weekends. And if late-night T service works out, bars and restaurants may follow by staying open later. And who knows, in another decade or so, we may catch up to New York City. In a couple of minutes, we're going to take your calls on this issue. But first, joining us on the line to talk about how it's going to work is Richard Davey. Rich is the Mass Department of Transportation Secretary, its Chief Executive Officer. Secretary Davey, good to talk to you.
Jim, Marjorie, how are you both?
Good. Great.
Terrific. Thank you so much for calling in, Rich. So what exactly is happening?
So next spring, Friday, Saturday nights, the MBTA will be running service, as you said, all of our subway lines and our top 15 bus routes until 3 a.m. So what does that mean? It means you'll be able to catch a train or a bus really in the downtown core till about 2:30 and get you home. So we're, you know, something our customers have been asking for a long time. Something we tried a little bit about 10 years ago just with bus service, and we think now, given the response that we've had and the questions we've received to launch the service, this can be a great success for the city.
And there was talk about fares and possible increases. Mm-hmm. What's the deal with that?
So at this point, we are going to charge the same base fare that we charge for all of the service. So it'll be $2 to take, you know, the subway, for example, if you have a Charlie card. We will not be ready to roll out any kind of changes in fares come March. But I expect, Marjorie, in the future that if this is to be sustained, that the T would probably have to have a higher fare after a certain hour, maybe midnight or 1 a.m. But at this point, we're not going to do that.
But didn't I see some surveys earlier that talked about how people were willing to pay more for the late-night service?
Absolutely. And if we could get – if I had any confidence that we could get the technology in place for March to do it, we would, but I don't. And so that's why we're not going to be increasing the fares in March. So it's really a question of – making sure the Charlie system would be able to do it. And it just is not compatible. When they built the Charlie system 5-6 years ago, it did not give us the capability to make changes for fares a time of day. You know, they should have, they didn't, but we're not going to be ready for March, and I just don't want this to be screwed up when we launch it. So,
hey, Rich, you worried about the money? I mean, $20 million
sure.
plus some corporate sponsor thing, which we want to ask you about in a minute. But this comes almost at the exact same time. Now you're saying the T is likely to run a deficit because of this arbitrator's award to one of your unions. So where's the dough coming from?
No, it's a good question, Jim. So we believe we can manage it for a couple of reasons. One, we're doing it over 2 fiscal years. So 3 months in this fiscal year, 9 months in next fiscal year. We have some one-time revenues. We're looking at some real estate deals, the corporate sponsorships that you mentioned as well. And $20 million is gross. That's not net of fares. So obviously we're going to collect fares, and we'll be able to reduce the cost. So we're very confident that the $20 million will be covered through the combination of sources I just said. But in the future, I think this goes back to Marjorie's point. That's why the T is going to have to consider charging more if this is to be sustained beyond the spring of 2015.
But you know something, you think about it, and we're talking with Richard Davey, the Mass Department of Transportation Secretary and Chief Executive Officer. When you think about it, it's a lot of college kids and people in their young 20s who now are either, if they don't have a car, and lots of them don't, having to, you know, take taxi cabs or something. So I can't imagine people are going to be upset that much if they can go from downtown back to Boston College or downtown back to Roslindale, you know, for even if it's $4. I mean, because they're going to save so much money. And it's not
easy. I got a letter from a guy named Jay Browday who was complaining after his 2 a.m. cold tea in Chinatown he couldn't get home.
You are really incorrigible.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing, right?
No, I mean, absolutely.
The drinking.
But it's also for the blue-collar workers, though, too. I mean, the folks that work at these bars and restaurants and would have to take cabs home as well. So I think it's good news for a number of folks. But your point's well taken, $3, $3.50 if we charged. I think it could be sustained for sure. And, again, we won't be ready to do that in March, but my expectation is that he would do that in the future.
Well, rather than send an email from Jay Browday, let Jay Browday ask you, who are these well-known, your quote, I think your line was well-known in the Globe yesterday, well-known corporate sponsors. Who are they?
Well, I'm not going to name names, but I can tell you we have had conversations with a few well-known brands who are been very interested, and I hope that we will be able to make some more announcements over the next few weeks. But the Globe happened to be the very first one that we nailed down over the last few days. So, you know, certainly companies that are looking, I think, to your point earlier about tapping the college students and 20-somethings to build their brand. So it could be the traditional, you know, brick-and-mortar businesses, and then some tech businesses, too, that are interested as well. So, you know, a lot of excitement about being associated with this. I saw some folks from the Globe last night. They told me this was one of the most, I think, tweeted and Facebooked-liked stories that the Globe, Boston.com, has ever run. So you can see that there's a lot of excitement that's been generated as a result of our announcement.
Well, also, it was a big issue in the mayor race. I had Marty Walsh on TV last night. I'm going to play it in a couple of minutes. And this was one of the things that Walsh was relentlessly talking about in terms of creating a different field. Let me understand one thing, though, about the corporate sponsors. When the paper says $20 million, is that reduced by the value of corporate sponsorships?
Yes.
Or it is. So theoretically, if you're able to sell a lot of these things, the cost could be the actual out-of-pocket for the tea could be negligible, right?
That's right. I mean, $20 million was the gross. So $20 million assumed no corporate sponsorships and absolutely no fares whatsoever. We're obviously going to do both. So we'll bring that down substantially. So at the end of the day, the cost that we're going to be underwriting with some other revenue sources will be, my expectation, a lot less than $20 million.
We're talking with Rich Davey, the Secretary of the Mass Department of Transportation, who does not drive a car, by the way. I guess the zip cars on the weekends. You know, I pardon my ignorance here, but I don't really understand this. What is in this for the Globe and other corporate sponsors? I mean, why would they – what are they getting out of this?
Yeah, well, certainly brand. I think if you were to talk to the Globe, it's some brand push. Obviously, the Globe has been.
What do you mean, ads?
Newspapers generally. Well, yeah, some ads for sure. I think they're going to be looking at advertising, certainly on the MBTA, some guaranteed levels of advertising.
Okay.
But what they're getting out of it, I think, is, you know, I mean, as you know, paper circulation is the actual tangible newspaper is declining, but getting folks, young folks, engaged on mobile devices, and I think that's probably what Boston Globe will do, is push Boston.com and other outlets for our younger customers. So that's, I think, where it's a sweet spot for a number of companies who are looking at tapping, you know, teens and 20-somethings, 30-somethings who are going to be taking the service at night.
Ooh,
I'm going to be selling the Bulldog edition of the Globe. It's my third job. Later.
I tell you, the Herald, Beacon, and GBH, any number of the brand, all the impressive brands that you two work for, I am happy to consider a sponsorship.
Hey, before you go away, in the story, and I think you said this a minute ago too, obviously you're going to judge it. There's a year trial period, and you're confident that unlike a decade or so ago, there's a lot bigger audience for this. We actually did speak to Brian McGorry, editor of the Globe, about the advertising and the thing I'm about to raise with you a few minutes ago. When we talk to him, I hope when you consider this, and the city considers how much it matters to it, it's not just about ridership. This changes, in my mind, and this is things that not just Marty Walsh, but Greg Selko from Boston Future Alliance, whoever talked about, it creates a different feel about the city, that it's essentially open for business. It's a late-night city in addition to what it's been. So it seems to me the allure, the appeal goes also to people who aren't going to ride the T at 1 a.m., but know it's there. Do you know where I'm going with this?
Absolutely. And you know, there's probably a whole discussion we could have about our puritanical roots here in New England, but absolutely. It gives it a different feel, different vibe. Folks have asked me, why is this going to be different than 10 years ago? Well, perfect example. I mean, the technology that we have available now, you know when your next train or next bus is coming.
Yeah, right.
10 years ago, you didn't have a clue. And so now there's a better sense for what the service can be and what it will be. So, again, another reason why I think it's going to be successful. But, Jim, your point's well taken. I mean, really making Boston world-class, one of the ways to continue to push that and do that is to make it more of a 24-hour city. And certainly running the T later on the weekends will allow us to do that.
So since I made that point to you now, I do not have to email you that point later. Is that what you're saying?
I will delete the J. Browday email I get later. You've got to find a better name, though, by the way.
Rich Davey, one last question for me. The thing we always heard was that one of the problems with doing this is because our trains and our tracks are so old and, you know, in Boylston Street they squeak and the noise. The maintenance, there wouldn't be time enough to do the maintenance. So you've obviously solved that problem?
So the answer is we have and we haven't. What I mean by that is running it on 2 hours later on Friday and 2 hours later on Saturday is not a big deal. To go to 7 days a week would be an impossibility because we are still going to be doing the track maintenance work between Sunday and Thursday night. And folks will say, well, why aren't you in New York? Well, New York, remember, I lived there for a couple of years. They've got both express, local and express tracks. So they have a lot more flexibility in how they run service at night. We don't. But if we were to try to extend this service beyond the weekends, it would be impossible because we're going to be down doing that maintenance. But Friday and Saturday night, we're not doing a lot, and we can schedule our maintenance around this. If we were to do more, then it would become a real problem.
Hey, Rich, I think I speak for both of us. This is great.
It's
great you're doing
exciting.
This. It's really exciting. Thanks.
Not that I've been up past 11 o'clock for the last, 7 years.
But now you have a reason to be. Hey, Rich, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you. Richard Davey is the Massachusetts Department of Transportation Secretary and Chief Executive Officer. We're going to open up the lines to you guys at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Is this going to make a difference to you? If you are somebody that likes to go downtown, likes to go out on the weekends, doesn't want to have to take a cab home or drive home, if you've been out cocktailing, is this going to make a difference to you? If you're somebody that works downtown, you know what else?
Cocktailing. As a verb. I love that. Go ahead.
And the other big thing, I mean, Emily Rooney talked about this, our colleague, you know, that so many restaurants, they shut down at like 9 o'clock at 10 o'clock. You can walk through the back bay and you can't get anything to eat.
I know that.
And if the tea is going to stay open, more restaurants are going to stay
open.
And I don't know what it's going to do to bar closings because I think that's legislated by the state, the hour the bars have to close.
No, but the assumption. But obviously the state's putting up this money, so obviously they're sensitive to the fact that Boston should be a city that's open later. I love the idea. What do you guys think? 877-301-8970. I have to say, I think the point I made at the end or near the end to Rich Davey, I think it's really important. It does create a totally different feel because you do say to yourself, well, you can't go downtown because if you have a couple of drinks, you can't drive. Or you just, whatever it is, it just creates a feel that I think is a really healthy one for the city going forward. By the way, last night I had Marty, before we get to your calls at 877-301-8970, Marty Walsh was kind enough to join me on television. I asked him a question about whether or not he thought he deserved some credit for this happening because he campaigned on it. I was 100% sure his answer was going to be, the governor, Rich Davey. It was refreshing and honest. Here's what Walsh had to say.
This came up during the campaign. I'm not sure if it would happen as quickly. I think, you know, that announcement that came today, actually, I'm happy for the announcement. It's a great way. It's a pilot program to see if we can really get some interest on T ridership, particularly at night. I'm glad it's happened. And I think the campaign, I mean, I haven't heard this from anybody. I'm sure the campaign had something to do with it.
Don't you love that? Because politicians always defer to everybody else on everything.
Well, both of them. I mean, Conley was pushing it big time and Marty Walsh was pushing it big time, saying, you know, what are we doing? Shutting down the T so early. I mean, I had a friend whose kid worked in Boston. He worked at one of the theaters. And when he was working the late night, he'd have to race over to get the train in time or else he was stranded. He lived in Somerville. Our number is 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Is this going to make any difference to you? Is this a good thing? I mean, we just got an email.
Who could be against this? We got an email from
Art. He's worried about the money, the $20 million. But I think,
sell corporate sponsorships.
I think Davey answered that in large part, saying that he's going to be able to bring that number down, he hopes, through these corporate sponsorships.
Well, it's also a certain – I mean, so what major American city other than Boston has its teeth shutting down when ours does? This is an obligation they've got. They've got to find the money. Let's go to Gary in Fall River, hometown of Marjorie Egan. You are first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Gary.
Yeah, hi. It's actually Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
And, yeah, it's fine. Hey, Marjorie.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. The reason I'm calling is, and again, I don't mean to say that this is a generality, but it just so happened that I met a guy this past summer who had been an engineer. He was an engineer for Amtrak. And I said, well, why the heck did you leave that job? That's a great job. And every boy's fantasy. I don't know about girls. But so he said, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I got to be an alcoholic working as an engineer. And, you know, I'm not saying that that's what engineers are. I'm saying that's what he said he was. But he also said that it was common in his experience.
Gary. And let me just say,
you
made the point. So let me just, Jerry, I'm sorry. Let me respond to this. One, if that were as widespread as you suggest, it's as much problem at 7 o'clock at night when it is running as it will be at 1 a.m. And two, they've been pretty meticulous about policing their own drivers. And
well, ever since the guy was caught texting while
I understand
driving.
What happened to him? It was a horrible situation.
Horrible.
The point is, and I don't think you can know in advance that someone's going to be texting. When he did, and there was a horrible outcome, he was dealt with. So I hear you, but I think, and I know you didn't mean it to be as broad a brush as it sounded. But I don't think that's the norm. But, Jerry, thank you so much for the call. 877-301-8970 is our number. We're talking about the new and, I think, wildly exciting decision that all the trains – I don't know why it's all. I should have asked them that. All the trains are going to be at work until 3 a.m. on Saturday. Is it Friday and Saturday?
Friday and Saturday.
And a number of selected bus routes. It is long, long overdue.
You know what I love about it?
No.
I live close to the T, so I can hear the trains at night, especially in the summertime.
So what do you like about that?
Well, I feel like I'm more hip and trendy when I can hear the trains, even though I'm not on the trains. Yes. I mean, they're still going late at night. It makes me feel like
I think
Rich
Davey's
going to
consider that when he decides.
Outside my window, even though I am not really participating. D from Jamaica Plain. What do you think about the T running until 3 o'clock in the morning on weekends?
Hi. Well, I pay a $70 monthly pass, and I'm wondering when they do increase the rate in March, I think it was.
Sometime in the spring. I don't know. Whether that's going to – boy, I wish we had asked that question. That's a great question. While the fares, individual fares, are apparently not, that's a very good question. Are they going to add something on to the monthly pass? I don't know what the answer is, but can I tell you something? If you go to the MBTA website – not only is there a direct email address for Rich Davey, who's the head of the transportation, he actually answers his email.
Well,
it's staggering.
He did say they're not going to raise any rates away.
Oh, he did say any rates?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's I'm sorry.
So he was saying that they're not that they may in the future be charging more for late night rides. They weren't going to do it.
So you think
right
he's speaking
away.
About monthly passes too?
So I'm not sure, but that's how it sounded to me that they don't have. They didn't want to wind up in an Affordable Care Act Obamacare disaster where he's trying to change the system and doesn't have it ready to change the system. So that's what he was saying. It's not.
You're
ready.
The first person who's compared the new late night tea to the healthcare.gov. Well, he was
talking
about,
for the call. You know, going online and getting your stuff done. So he's not going to do it right away. And it sounded to me like he was going to charge put increases on for late night only. That's how it's.
If he does right, if they do it all
correct.
Let's go to Chris in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Chris.
Hi. Yes, long overdue access between Cambridge and Boston itself. You know, with this the construction recently on the bridges is prohibitive for young people moving in and out of the city if they want, you know, access over to Cambridge or into Boston. It's just horrendous, let alone from the burbs.
Yeah, it is a mess, that Longfellow Bridge. It just looks awful, doesn't it?
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
It's...
Well, and just that, even if they do it for the period of time that the bridge is under construction.
No, once they start it, I hear you. But this is what modern cities do. People
exactly.
are up. People are moving. It's about time.
Exactly.
And it's one of the, and Tom Menino, I thought, did wonderful things on a bunch of fronts. He was fairly resistant to this in some ways.
Well, he was
but I think
very,
it's a generational thing,
he
too.
He was very
Chris,
sensitive
thanks.
To people complaining about the noise. You know, if they live near bars, if they're in the South End or the Back Bay and the bars are getting out late. And he was very sensitive to that. And older people are very reliable voters, so you can understand why he was.
How many times do you think through the years, Marjorie, in this job and in our prior incarnation, we spoke to Rich Davey either as the Secretary of Transportation or head of the T, which he was before. How many times? Two dozen?
Quite a few.
Do you know there's never been one time you've spoken to Rich Davey about any topic where you did not mention what? What did you mention every single conversation?
I don't know.
The squeak on the train when it turns on Boylston Street.
Because I was in a job for 3 years where I took the Green Line every day to Arlington Street. And every day you get to Boylston. And people that ride the Green Line know what I'm talking about. The squeak on Boylston. You have to put your fingers in your ears. It is so loud and so annoying. And they can't fix it, apparently, because the tracks are so old
curvy.
Or something. It's so old. But you just want to kill yourself. It's like if you drive every morning and all of a sudden you knew for about a minute and a half your fingernail was going to be coming down the chalkboard. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
It's very disturbing, Jim, and I feel I've been psychologically damaged by having to listen to that squeak for all those years.
If nothing, you are relentless. I mean, it's a great quality, and I admire it.
Well, I don't take the tea anymore to work, so there you go. Okay, up next, we're going to be joined by Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy. We'll get his take on tea late night service, delivery drones, and a lot more. That conversation coming up in 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're joined on the phone by the man who joins us every Wednesday at about this time. He is the editor of the Boston Globe. Hello there, Brian McGroy.
Hello there, Jim Browdy. Hello there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm very well, Brian McGroy. I must say, though, I was stunned when I woke up this morning. I hear the radio. I hear the name Brian McGroy, editor of the Boston Globe.
I
open up the newspaper. I see editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy. Apparently, you were the star of a tribute at the John F. Kennedy Library last night to the outgoing mayor of Boston, Thomas Menino. What did you say, Brian?
Well, first of all, first time the word star has ever been mentioned in a sentence that included my name, so I wouldn't get carried away if I were you, Marjorie.
We weren't invited. Jim and I were not invited.
No,
of course you were. You're implicitly invited to everything.
Implicitly.
It was a nice event. Look, it was a panel discussion I took part in with Peter Mead, currently the head of the BRA, and Jack Beattie, the renowned author, great thinker, and Liz Walker.
And guy who's writing the autobiography or biography of Tom Menino with Tom Menino, right?
Yes, exactly. And Liz Walker, the former television anchorwoman, now a minister. And it was a poignant event. As I stated from the stage of the Kennedy Library last night, a little awkward for me, a little counterintuitive to have a news person up there as part of a panel at a tribute, but I'd like to think I thread the needle, maybe not, but time will tell.
Well, also, he's leaving. I mean, if the guy was running for re-election, I assume he would
have
been
there. Well, I did ask him. The first thing I said was, you know, promise me, Mayor, you're not going to be running again in 4 years. And he waved his Louisville Slugger cane and said he was not. So I think it worked out okay.
You know, you said how poignant it was, we had Tom Menino in here for a half hour, I don't know, three or
and
four days ago.
We did not ask him any tough questions.
No,
either.
He's leaving office.
It was a farewell interview.
But that's not even my point. I love the fact that Menino is not playing the tough guy on the way out. And when I say tough guy, I mean like, no, it's no big deal. You know, I did my 20 years. I'm moving on. I'm just going to be – there's clear melancholy there. And the fact that he's willing to express it, I feel, in a very vulnerable, honest way, is pretty great from a strong guy mayor, don't you think?
You know, yes, I agree. The one thing that's always struck me about Tom Menino, and I think one of the more underrated aspects of his personality is he's very wise, and I think he's gotten even wiser with age and experience in office. He knows himself, has gotten to know himself pretty well, and he understands this is an extraordinarily tough thing he's going through. The old slogan about Kevin White was a loner in love with the city, and Menino loves the city as much as anyone I think any of us have ever seen, and he is giving up a vantage in the city that is really difficult for him to walk away from, and I think he understands it's the right thing to do. He basically had to do it. But that doesn't necessarily make it any easier when it's in progress.
Well, you know, it's funny. We went to a mutual friend of ours, Ben Bradley, had a new book we interviewed here on the radio about Ted Williams, the kid. And he had an event last night for the book opening. And Marty Walsh came in, the new mayor of the city of Boston. And it's amazing to watch. I mean, if Marty Walsh had been a state representative, which he has been for, what, 16 years, you know, there's a state rep. He was swarmed because everybody wants a piece of the mayor of the city. And that's going to be an interesting phenomenon for Tom Menino, too. You know that I mean, in some ways, it's going to be a relief not to be so swarmed. As he said, you'll find out who your real friends are. But on the other hand, it's going to be weird.
It's going to be very strange. And I think if you're Tom Menino, you're wondering, you know, come January 7th or 8th, when you're over at Boston University and you make a phone call to somebody, who returns it? How
he
fast
said that
do they
to
return
us.
It?
Yeah.
And I actually think he's legitimately curious about that. It was funny last night. I was leaving the JFK library and Menino was quite literally swarmed off the side of the stage. And I ran into Marjorie over at the Ben Bradley book event. Marjorie was, of course, swarmed in her own right as the biggest celebrity there.
I left early because I was appalled by the swarm, actually. So
There was no swarm.
I mean, I gave her a wave over the crowd, and she was kind enough to give me a very brief acknowledgement, I appreciate, Marjorie.
I was talking to Larry Lucchino, Brian. What could I say?
It's funny you say that, Brian, in terms of that wave, because I said to her this morning, did McGrory ever show up? She says, I have no idea. So,
No, he didn't.
But the point is that, I left Menino. He has swarmed. I show up at the book party, and there's Marty Walsh, who I didn't see him as swarmed. There were people around him, but
swarmed is an exaggeration, but there were quite a few people around him continually.
It was just funny to see not funny in a ha-ha way, but it was unique to see the old and the new and whatnot, the guy on his way out, the guy on his way in. And, it's going to be a very interesting thing for the city to adjust to a new mayor like this.
Ooh, too bad you couldn't write a column about that. Wouldn't that be great?
Why
don't you write the column?
Because I wasn't there. I can't do it. Hey, let's move on to something else. Kudos to Farrah Stockman, your terrific columnist. She did an awesome job yesterday talking about the proposed increase in the police department salaries by 25%, talking about how a lot of cops in Boston make more than the mayor. They make more than Patrick, some of them make more than Secretary of State John Kerry. But I thought her most compelling argument was right at the end of the story, saying that if the cops in Boston took a 12% raise instead of a 25% raise, then the city could afford things like 17 more Orchard Garden turnaround schools in the city. To me, it was the most compelling thing. But Brian, the word on the street is the city council is going to say fine to
today.
The police officers.
Today. Happens today, yes.
I mean, I guess I'm asking you an opinion, and I know you feel awkward about this, but to me, if you are a resident of Boston, this is a losing situation. If you have kids in the schools, if you're worried about snowplows, you're worried about anything else, these guys are averaging $109,000 a year.
Look, you guys do this to me every week. You ask for my opinion. I always say I can't give it, and then I give it because just like I fall for it every time. That's usually right before you ask, am I going to survive in my job here?
Yes.
Is my boss going to survive in my job? So these weekly sessions become increasingly fun, more enjoyable. So I appreciate this very much.
Having said that,
look, at the tough part, Farrah did a terrific
she
column.
Did.
It was great.
It was a very gutsy column. It was what I liked is they gave her extra space for this. She really went in depth on it. It was very well reported. If you're somebody in this economy who is on the lower, the mid to lower echelons of the ladder, you have not seen raises anywhere near what they are proposing for the police department, anywhere near, if you've seen raises at all. So a lot of people in the city have a tough time relating to any class of people that are about to get a 25% pay raise. So I think that kind of speaks for itself.
And for whatever it's worth, I had Marty Walsh on television last night, and I asked Marty specifically, the mayor-elect specifically, If he was urging the city council to take a position, a particular position, I knew what the answer was going to be. And his view, his response was, it's not his place, even though he's going to have to deal with the consequences of either a yes or no vote today, even though a yes is more likely. Speaking about something.
Aren't you going to defend the police officers, Jim?
I would, but I am not comfortable taking a position on these issues.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
Look, I mean, but that's beside the point. Yeah. Being a cop is hard work. I come from a family of Boston cops. It's hard work. It is potentially dangerous work, but that doesn't mean that the average taxpayer doesn't have a tough time stomaching the idea of a 25%
raise. Yeah, but you know what the problem is, Brian, on this thing? And I am actually a fan of Bill Weld's, even as a person in a lot of ways, because he's really a really smart, energetic thing. One of the things I really resented was when, and you'll understand the parallel in a minute, was the day that Weld, as governor, stood on the State House steps. He was talking, I don't know, about a teacher's contract or something, or maybe funding for education, and saying, you know, a lot of teachers, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said essentially this, haven't read a book in years. And the reason I bring that up is my concern is when there's this constant drumbeat from everybody about how the arbitration award is too much, sort of like Bill Weld saying teachers haven't read a book, the message it sends to the public about either respecting a teacher or, I think, respecting a cop is a troubling one. It's sort of a pile-on. This is what the arbitrator awarded, Marjorie.
Excuse me. We have talked many times on the show. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Brian. We have talked many times on the show about the reticence, and we've talked about this with you, Brian, of news organizations or politicians to look too carefully into the missteps of police. The Todashev case where the young man died down in Orlando. We still don't know how he died.
He was associated
with
a cop.
Well, we don't know
FBI.
How many
well,
bullets in his head.
FBI, yeah.
Right, but we don't know. Was it two bullets? Was it six bullets? I mean, the secrecy around that and the and are being loath. Tom Gagin wrote this in the Boston Globe, being loath to look into the cops' performance in Watertown. So you can't say that we don't respect cops. It's almost like if you question the police on their salary or on their conduct in a situation like the Watertown shootout, you're viewed as unpatriotic or a bad American. And Brian, you know this as a columnist, and I know this because I was opposed to police details. It's pretty scary picking up the phone if you take a stance that's against a powerful union like that.
Yeah, you're right, although I think I would offer some disagreement to both of you. To Jim, it was a point I was trying to make before that just because you believe that a 25% pay raise is pretty significant in this economy doesn't mean you don't respect the job they do. And I think those issues have to be separated because, again, you don't want that kind of Weldian play at work here where just because you oppose the raise, that means you don't respect what they do. I differ with that. And to Marjorie, look, I do think we do a pretty good job of holding law enforcement agencies accountable. The Globe did some pretty extensive reporting on how those shots were fired, what happened over in Watertown that night. We have fought hard for more transparency in terms of what happened in Orlando and with the FBI. We are looking at some issues right now that I'm not at liberty to discuss, but that involve police agencies. I think that we are fairly vigilant on that stuff. So, I don't know.
By the way, some of our colleagues at GBH, like Philip Martin,
yeah,
others have done great work on this, too. Okay, Brian, let's move to something else, if we can here. There are a number of questions, as many as seven potentially, headed to the 2014 ballot, the two most prominent of which potentially is one, which would repeal the automatic inflation adjustment on the gas tax, and another one that still needs Supreme Judicial Court approval would repeal the whole casino law. Here's my take on what's going to happen, and it's sort of a 1990 when I was involved in a tax repeal question. I was opposed to it, which took center stage in the race between Bill Weld, the Republican, and John Silver, the Democrat. My guess is at the end of the day, the Republican nominee, obviously Charlie Baker, is going to be for the repeal of the gas tax inflation adjustment. The Democrat's going to be on the other side. My guess is that Charlie Baker is going to be somewhere pretty close. I don't know if he's that. We're actually going to have him on tomorrow. We'll find out. For repeal of the casino law, or at least advocating for just one casino like he did when he ran against Deval Patrick. And the Democrat is going to be for keeping the casino law. Are we going to have another campaign in 2014 where those issues are going to potentially overwhelm everything else because people get to vote on them on the same day they're voting for the next governor of the Commonwealth?
I mean, it's an interesting question. And I don't know. I kind of enjoyed thinking back to you in 1990 again. That was good the way you brought that up. But
he always slips that in, doesn't he?
Very discreetly.
Did you write anything about, where were you, in Washington? Why didn't you write any columns about that?
The glory days of Jim Rowdy.
He was a hero from Provincetown to Springfield.
Probably been a good couple of hours since he flipped through his big booklet of clips.
It was actually not a couple of hours. It was a few minutes ago as I was walking down in the studio, if you must know, Brian.
The reality is, I think it's really difficult to know, sitting here right now, what the major issues of the gubernatorial race are going to be. And as you and I both know, often the biggest issues in any gubernatorial or any political race are not the issues at all. They're the candidates themselves. And I don't want to hazard a guess on what the issues might be. I think you pinpointed two significant issues, but I'm not ready to say that those are going to be in any way overwhelming the rest of the race.
Can I tell you something also? Unlike Marjorie, who puts you on the spot every week just to do it, I am not going to ask you what you think of Charlie Baker's selection of Karen Polito as lieutenant
governor. Well, where have you been on this?
Well, it's funny you should say that. The day before he picked her, we had Peter Kadzis, who is the former editor of the Phoenix, one of his reporters, David Bernstein. Marjorie and I are in here. And Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, all four of us, when we heard that Polito was announcing, said, oh, my God, this puts Charlie Baker in a really tough position. There's going to be that video of her with Alan West, sort of the darling of the Tea Party, former congressman from Florida, and sort of nutty. And they're going to say, and what does Charlie do? He doesn't want to reject her. And then the next day, showing how we know nothing about, at least I know nothing about politics, he embraces her, goes to her event, and picks her. So I have to say, I think he needed a woman. He lost, how many points did he lose to Deval? By 24? He needed a woman. There aren't that many Republican women. She's a fabulous campaigner.
Fabulous campaigner.
Fabulous campaigner. But I think there are going to be Democratic ads early on trying to tie her to the Tea Party and in part taint Charlie Baker, who is running as what I think he is, which is pretty much a moderate on most things. So my long-winded answer is I'm not sure, but I was dead wrong 3 days ago.
So can I give a quick take on this?
Yes, sure. Absolutely.
Nobody cares who the lieutenant governor candidate is, except for the 100 people who love to chatter to each other.
You're exactly right.
And you had four of those 100 on your show.
Exactly. I was one of them.
Nobody cares who the lieutenant governor
unless
candidate
is. Unless it's Sarah Palin. Would you agree? I mean, number two, obviously not lieutenant governor. Would you not agree that that had some impact? I generally agree with you. The number two means nothing. You don't think Palin's presence on a ticket with an older guy who's at...
But that's
the president.
That's the outlier that proves a rule. You know, that wasn't so much about Sarah Palin. That reflected on the ability of the who picked her to make that choice.
Judgment. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was a story, either the Herald or the Globe story, I'm not sure which one, pointed out that Polito got huge votes in the Worcester area. And
she got more votes than Charlie Baker in the last election.
He's not from Worcester, and so that she could probably help him up at that end of the state. So what's going on? The Globe is in business now with the MBTA and the late night service. I mean, I'm thrilled they're going to be a late night thing, but you guys are sort of sponsoring this. What does that mean?
We're not in business with the MBTA. We are. They are soliciting private sector help, and the Globe has signed up as a so-called co-sponsor. My understanding of it, and I don't think I'm supposed to say anything publicly, but here goes anyways. I think we're just providing some in-kind advertising for them, and the Globe has editorialized often that late-night tea service would be beneficial to the entire area, and that we should have it. We lag behind other cities in that. And Chris Mayer, the publisher, has smartly put some Globe resources where the Globe's opinion is, and will provide some in-kind resources for the tea to market this.
Yeah, I do think it's great that it's going to be open, at least for short period of time, the trial period, because I think this time, unlike the last time, it's going to succeed.
Yeah, but it's not just about succeeding. Let me just say, I lived in New York City. It's about me again, Brian. Bear with me for a second. I lived in New York.
Jim, you know, when it's about you, you don't have to tell me. When it's not about you, give me a newsflash.
So you know what Brian McGrory said to me one time? I don't know if you said to me on the air or off the air, but it was so apt, and Jim will get
say?
A kick out of it. Said that you feel as though when Jim is not talking, as is when I'm talking, and I know it's true when I'm talking, or even when you're talking, Brian, because he likes to talk more to you, he's bored.
No, I said that. Did Brian, did you actually say that? That's Jim is nervous
excited.
Laughter.
Jim is excited that I said it because it was about him.
Exactly. Now that I think about it, I'm fine. No, but as I was saying, Brian, before I was rudely interrupted, I lived in New York City for 15 years. One of the
did
things
you,
I
Jim? Did you?
Well, I did. One of the things
That's
I
right.
loved
he
about
he was a legal services star.
I was. One of the things I loved about New York City was how everything was open all the time, and I used almost none of the things other than the Empire Diner, which I really loved, which was a 24/7 thing. The point I'm trying to make is even if you don't use the T when it's open until 3 a.m., it makes a statement about the city, particularly for those so-called innovation economy, the 20 and 30-somethings. That's as important as actually the users, isn't it?
Having the opportunity, having the option, having it there, having it ready to be used is critical. And I hope that this pilot program doesn't base success on just the number of people who use it, because it's exactly as you said, Jim, it's the intangible of knowing it's there, knowing it's available. That's what really counts.
Okay, before we let you go, did you tell us or did you write, were you a paper boy when you were a kid?
Where's this going?
No, it's not going anywhere. It's a factual question.
I had a 52 paper route.
In
the town of Weymouth, back when every Wednesday was food day, and the paper was backbreakingly heavy.
So wow. Here's where this is going. Can you imagine? I know that particularly with John Henry there, there's sort of a new era for the Globe. Can you imagine octocopters delivering the Boston Globe to people's? I'm serious. I mean, I'm trying to help you out there. Is that not – what did you think of this Amazon thing with Jeff Bezos? How great is that?
It was so bizarre to see the photo of these drones that would be delivering your – you know, if you order a box of shower caps or something, and the thing is flying through the air and dropping it on your front lawn. Maybe someday this will be the norm, but my God, it's like something right out of the Jetsons.
You know what? You know who's really upset about it, by the way? I don't know if you know, since you mentioned before, Ben Bradley. You know why?
Oh, Ben Bradley, why?
Because his book weighs 11 pounds, and it can only deliver up to 5.
Yeah, I fell for a hook, line, and sinker, skeptical reporter than I am. And then people were saying, oh, no, it was just a publicity stunt to get on 60 Minutes and time it and all that. I thought it was true. I don't know if it's true or not true now.
Would these drones, I mean, are we going to have drones crashing into drones over...
We discussed that.
Like the birds.
I say, right, like Alfred Hitchcock's movie, because the assumption is everybody... I'm serious. If this is real, I don't know enough about technology to know if it's real, at least in the time frame that Bezos is talking about. But, I mean, think about it. I mean, it, you know, instant gratification, and if it works for Amazon, why would everybody from the Postal Service to literally newspapers, why wouldn't everybody experiment with delivery via octocopter?
And then it turns into the science fiction movie where the sky is filled with these insect-like creatures just, you know, propelling through the air.
And Marjorie's never going to leave her house. We had this discussion the other day.
I'm very excited about it. Very excited about it. And I want to tell you that a lot of book party people, Brian McGrory, said how much they loved listening to you on the radio last night.
Did they really?
Yes, they did. I just want to pass that along. I said thank you very
you, Marjorie.
Much. You're very
thank
welcome.
You.
I was glad they were tuning in.
I had left because I already greeted my fans. I had to.
Once the conversation turned away from Jim, he just bored out of his brain.
It's true. I'm glad you said it. I don't know if I told you that when I talk for more than one sentence, Brian, that Jim motions me, makes these motions for me to hurry up and hurry up and hurry up.
Flow is critical
in
radio.
I've
told you that.
I tend to stutter and mispronounce things a lot, you know, which is unfortunate being on the radio. But when Jim's on vacation, I don't stutter and mispronounce things a lot. What do you think that's about?
I just want to recap the show. So, Jim, did you live in New York before you came to Massachusetts to help raise our taxes? I'm just trying to get
Brian McGrory, it's been a pleasure. Brian is the editor of the Boston Globe. We'll talk to you next week. Brian,
thank you very much, Brian. As always, love to talk to you. You will be with us again next Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Okay, another conversation all about Jim. We're moving on now. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Peniel Joseph from Tufts University. We're going to look at how race dynamics are still locked in a 20th century paradigm when it comes to our prison system. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marge Regan. Here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is Peniel Joseph. He's a history professor at Tufts, founding director for the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Tomorrow at 7:30, Tufts is hosting civil rights lawyer Michelle Alexander, who will be discussing her new book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And one of the many grim realities that Alexander points out in her book, one of many, is that today there are more black men behind bars or under the watch of the criminal justice system than there were enslaved in 1850, right before the Civil War. Peniel, good to see you again.
Hey, great to see you.
Hey, thank you for coming in, Peniel. So what is Alexander's thesis?
Well, the main thesis is that in the 21st century, we have a new form of Jim Crow that stigmatizes primarily African-American males. So the old Jim Crow was not only separate but equal, black and white signs in terms of public accommodations, water fountains, disallowing people to go to theaters that were all white, swimming pools, libraries, etc. The old Jim Crow was also a stigma, a racialized stigma that prevented you from voting, that prevented you from having equal access, equal citizenship. For some, there was something called the convict lease system at the end of the 19th century, which basically arrested African-American men on charges of things like loitering and vagrancy. And what happened to those men went to jail, had felony convictions, and then were leased out to private corporations that paid local municipalities maybe $1 or $2 a day for their labor. And there's a great book by Douglas Blackman that won a Pulitzer Prize called Slavery by Another Name that really documents in meticulous fashion between roughly 1880s to the 1920s how this happened. So her argument is that by the 1980s, the drug war had an unintended consequence. And that unintended consequence was, instead of fighting crime and ending the crack cocaine scourge in the 1980s, it actually stigmatized black men because it brought in a whole new wave of incarcerated black men into the prison system who had felony convictions based on the drug wars.
And by the way, the numbers that she cites, a third of black men will go to prison in their lifetime. In major cities, this one blew me away, half of working age blacks are either in jail, men that is, are either in jail or are felons. You used the term unintended consequence. The sense I get from reading, I haven't read the book, but reading about it, is that she thinks it was an intended consequence. That if it wasn't, not that somebody's sitting in some back room and saying, okay, let's go get all these 27-year-old black guys and put them in the slammer, essentially to roll back the Civil Rights Act. But she says there was this sort of conscious notion. Is that not a fair description of where she is on this?
Yeah. When I say unintended, what I mean is that it's not a conspiracy theory.
Okay.
She's definitely saying that it was intentional in terms of this marginalization and this stereotyping of black men as sort of criminal predators and sort of rounding them up. But unintentional in the sense of there was no grand design. What this is sort of the logical consequences of a series of different behaviors by politicians, by suburbanites who had a fear of crime, and not just in the West Coast, but especially the Midwest, which is also a factory for private prison industries in places like Iowa and other places that have actually low crime, but the private industry has provided employment over there. A lot of times that employment is for young white men of working class origins who are incarcerating young black men of working class.
And those prisons are in much better shape than a lot of the schools that the young black men have either graduated from or attended or that sort of thing. You mentioned the suburbs, Peniel Joseph, a minute ago. And what makes this relevant, I assume, and believable, as she gets into, and it's not just Michelle Alexander, a lot of people have looked at this too, is it the response many people say was, well, young black men are committing the drug crime, so young black men are going to go to prison or at least be charged. But the contention is made by Alexander and many others, and you may be among them, that white suburban kids in relatively similar circumstances are committing as many drug crimes or those sort of things. And they're not, there's no sweep in the suburbs. There's none of this sort of thing. It is more targeted to urban situations.
Absolutely. She makes the argument in New Jim Crow that about there's 19 million people who take drugs per year. Only 10% of them have any kind of connection with law enforcement. Drug enforcement is something where you have to profile communities, whether they be suburban or urban, rich or poor, black or white, because that's the only way you can have interdiction and stop drug trafficking, stop drug use. When we look at the statistics, blacks and whites use drugs at relatively the same rate. In the 1980s, one of the surprising statistics is that whites used crack cocaine more than African Americans.
Because they're more whites?
Because there's more whites.
I mean, okay.
It's because they're more whites. And what's interesting about that is that when we think about drug use, crack cocaine and the anti-crime laws of the 1980s, what they do is set up racial disparities, not by saying specifically we're going to try to target black people, just by saying that we're going to turn crack cocaine into an offense that's actually a more egregious offense versus powdered cocaine. And the fact that African Americans are around the crack cocaine trade much more than the powdered cocaine, and white Americans are around powdered cocaine more than crack cocaine. So what's interesting is the law is it's colorblind, but it's color-coded in terms of its outcomes.
Well, also, part of the thing was that you could get a couple of hits of crack cocaine for a lot less money than it was going to cost you to go out and buy a gram of, I don't know what it costs these days. It wasn't like $100 a gram, or that's a lot of money to shell out. So if you could go over for $5 and get a couple of hits of crack, which if you're poor, obviously, is a lot easier.
Absolutely. Crack became the drug of choice for poor and working class people. So one of the interesting arguments she makes is that the new Jim Crow is really racialized, but there's a class component.
Yeah.
It's poor black people and poor black men who've been marginalized. And unfortunately, this is bipartisan. Both Democratic and Republican administrations anti-crime policy, but also the Bill Clinton, the Omnibus Crime Bill that was passed in 1996, set up a context where ex-offenders could no longer live in public housing. Ex-offenders could no longer get welfare benefits, things like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So ex-offenders actually have, you check the box, and Michelle Alexander talks about this, you check the box that you're an ex-offender or a felon for employment applications, and you stand zero chance. Because Princeton sociologists have done studies where black men with college degrees have a harder time getting employment than white men who have who are ex-offenders.
Yeah, but how dumb can these and Bill Clinton,
it's true in Boston,
not a stupid,
by the way.
What's
it's
that?
True in Boston, in public housing. If there's drug offenses in your house, say your son gets arrested in a drug offense, you could lose your
eviction.
Home if
Absolutely.
You're the mom with other children. And then where are you supposed to go? You know, you don't want your kid to be out dealing drugs, but you pay the price.
But can I get back to the rationale for this? I understand pandering politicians. I mean, it's almost redundant. I don't care what the issue is. You obviously want to – there's a piece of the population you want to have an appeal to. But if people are scared of crime, what dumber thing can you do than ensure that when a kid gets out of prison – it's unlikely he can find a place to live. It's unlikely he's going to be able to find a job. It's unlikely he's going to be able to get some supplemental food assistance. You're basically saying, I'm going to guarantee as best I can that this kid's going to be a recidivist and create further problem or knock off a neighborhood 7-Eleven or knock me over. I mean, so where's the rational thinking on this? I mean, even if racism is not the motivational force behind a lot of these politicians, what are they thinking?
Well, Michelle Alexander argues that it's about the late 60s, early 1970s, and the fear of law and disorder. So it's about Nixon's silent majority. I would take
Wait,
that.
Now that because we're providing civil rights to blacks, they're going to rise up and do something horrible, and so we're going to make sure that we keep them down? Is that the notion?
Well, it was a fear of crime. It was a fear of, there was urban decay. We think about New York City in the 1970s. Certainly, it's a city falling apart. What's interesting is that
coincidentally, that's when I lived there, by the way. I don't want to, for whatever
your
that's
fault,
worth.
Jim.
Go
you
ahead.
Know, what's interesting is that we talk about chocolate cities and vanilla suburbs in the 1970s. So there's a phenomenon of white flight away from places like Detroit, New York City, Chicago, major urban areas. And what you found was decaying urban cities presided over by African-American mayors, David Dinkins in New York, Harold Washington in Chicago, Coleman Young in Detroit, Maynard Jackson in Atlanta. And these cities were on the decline. So what's interesting is that there was a crime problem. There was a violence problem. But the solution became punitive and punishment instead of rehabilitation and investment in cities. So at the same time that African Americans head these major cities, federal investment in cities goes down from 15% to 5% of cities' budgets. So there's really no way to turn. And so what's interesting is that the tough on crime policies were also predicated on the fact that there was such rigid racial segregation going on. So you said that, yes, it wouldn't be a great productive thing to have a young black man have no place to go. But part of this is based on the fact that neighborhoods are so rigidly segregated. So what? If the person has nothing to do, you're really literally not seeing this person. Not only do they live on the wrong side of the tracks, they live on the other side of the city from you.
Well, you know, I think this whole thing is fascinating in terms of racial politics, because I think a lot of white people, they're not thinking for 5 minutes about what's going on in the inner cities of America because they're out in the suburbs. It's not kind of their problem. But on the other hand, you do see a phenomenon. I don't want to get ahead of myself. We're going to talk about solutions later. But I think the interesting phenomenon on this move across the country to get less upset about marijuana is because so many middle-class white people have smoked marijuana for 40 years and nobody believes these terrible stories about marijuana anymore. And it's very interesting. I remember, and you may, Peniel, as well, I remember this piece a white guy wrote for Atlantic magazine, because the theory was, once you have a hit of crack cocaine, it's all over. You're like an addict and your life is over. This white college boy from wherever he was, Harvard or Princeton or something, went in and smoked crack cocaine, bought it in the inner city, and said, you know what? I'm not addicted. You know, I can see the high. I get it. But his theory was that it was a coping mechanism. If you're living in poverty, you get no options. You know, your kids are screaming. The father of your kids is left. It's easy to go out and get high for an hour to just kind of forget your issues. That's where the impulse came from, not because there was this drug that was causing you to be addicted. And then allowing social services to come in and take your children, allowing all these terrible things to have your family taken apart. It wasn't the drug, it was the poverty.
Yeah, I think poverty is the big 500-pound gorilla in the room here when you talk about the new Jim Crow, because there's one of the most poignant parts of the book is when she talks about how many black men are forced to plead out to felony convictions, whether they're innocent or guilty. Because unlike she makes the comparison to the television show Law and Order, that most people don't get represented by public defenders. So if you're in the South, if you're in the inner city, there's such a big backlog. And she makes the connection that the reason the backlog is so big is ironically because of the drug war. So many low-level, nonviolent offenders are in the system. The system got overwhelmed 20, 25 years ago. So poverty is a big part of this, because if you're charged with a felony drug conviction and you're middle or upper middle class, your parents are going to fight that tooth and nail because they realize what that can do to you. So an ADA, assistant district attorney, is not going to is probably going to, if you're represented well, cut a deal with you that's not a felony conviction, that's going to carry with you, because she argues that that felony conviction is a scarlet letter that you have for the rest of your life. In 14 states, you can't vote with a felony conviction, even after you're away from parole and away from probation. You cannot vote. And that's connected directly, I should tell everybody, to Reconstruction policies and after the Civil War and the attempt to stop black men from voting.
By the way, as a former public defender myself, let me say, I don't know where you're coming from on this, but the bottom line, most people's argument, I hope yours too, Peniel, is it's not the quality of representation. It's the realities. Most public defenders have caseloads that are taller than they are.
No,
and
absolutely.
The realities don't have enough time to give.
No, it's not the quality. No, it's, yeah. The system is inundated.
Right. It's inundated, yeah. and they're paid lousy money, and they're fighting every year to get reasonable pay for these attorneys, and they're underfunded year after year.
Absolutely.
Okay, so after I indicted virtually every politician in America, I'm going to make the other side of the argument for a second. How about a mayor and a police chief who's sitting down in a city and saying, listen, this is the way to deal with the violent crime problem. Take the young kids who are doing drug stuff, which we admit is relatively minor, they say, off the streets and through the back door, for lack of better expression, we're going to attack the violent crime problem. Any merit to that?
Well, no, I don't think so in this sense. If one of the things that young people need is jobs, education, housing, right? And really a sense of civic responsibility and a sense that there's going to be opportunity for them, right? So the reason why in so many drug-torn communities, whether it's Chicago or Bowdoin, Geneva, right here in Boston, the reason why so many young people behave in ways that people think are counterproductive or antisocial is because of poverty, because of a lack of education. African-American males have a very high high school dropout rate in comparison to their white counterparts. So rehabilitation would be, you don't want to do this massive sweep, because eventually these young people go back into those communities and they go back now as hardened ex-offenders and ex-prisoners.
And
okay, so you mentioned, I'm sorry.
It's not just that. I mean, we always talk about the fatherlessness issue in the inner cities. And needless to say, if you can't get a job, you can't function, you can't bring home any money, it's hard to maintain that family unit. And I think that's part of the reason there are so many guys that don't try, because they have no wherewithal to do it.
Absolutely.
They can't get a job.
Hey, so You mentioned a black adult man or something like that. There's a black adult man who's president of the United States. Yeah. We happen to live in a state where we have the first black governor. Are these guys any better on these issues than their white predecessors and counterparts are?
Well, I think they have been. I think in terms of Obama, the Justice Department's recent decision to Attorney General Eric Holder made the speech in August about changing its crime fighting philosophy, especially with respect to the drug war and with respect to black men. He gave a speech before the American Bar Association in San Francisco where he said too many people are being put in jail for too long for reasons that don't make sense. And he said
Is that about race or budgets, though, from Eric Holder's position?
It was about race and budgets. And he says that in the speech. He says that, you know, black men for the same crimes are being sentenced longer sentences than their white counterparts. And he's saying this at the federal level. And so he was giving us in that speech empirical evidence. And he said, hey, this is unfair. This is discrimination. And on my watch, this is going to stop. That's real progress. The sad part is that only 14% of inmates are in the federal system. So the federal system jumped from 25,000 in 1980 to 219,000. By 2010. So 790% jump. But most incarcerated people are in state and local and county prisons.
But yeah, staying on Obama just for a second before we get back to Deval Patrick, here is Michelle Alexander in a National Public Radio interview. How do you rate President Obama's performance? I've been very disappointed. He's had numerous opportunities to speak boldly, forcefully about the harms of the drug war. What we see is that in his drug policy budget, he's invested about the same ratio of dollars to enforcement as compared to prevention as the Bush administration did. That's disappointing, to say the least, isn't it?
Well, no, I think it's disappointing. I think she's probably speaking before Holder's decision. So I think the first term was very, very...
Actually, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, the first term was very, very disappointing. But I think starting in the second term, and he really let Holder speak for him in this sense, because I do think that he has to let the attorney general speak for him, because I think politically it's better off to let Holder speak progressively about drug wars and crime and race than the president of the United States. Because in a way, that could just hamper his whole second term agenda.
How about Holder? How about if Holder's new agenda was fewer young black men in jail for drug crimes and more white masters of the universe from Wall Street in jail for bigger crimes?
Nice.
How about that?
That is one of the incredible things here, that none of these guys, these masters of the universe, ever go to jail.
None.
Absolutely none. How about Deval Patrick? He talks a lot about CORE reform in Massachusetts. It's been a very hard sell, but at least he's trying
criminal
to
record
do something.
Reform,
yeah, so you don't know, and that's controversial because people say, well, I want to know if somebody robbed a bank 20 years ago. On the other hand, if they did it 20 years ago and they've been straight for 20 years, why do you need to know? Or if they had a drug problem.
I think Duval is right on CORE reform, and I think that so far his intentions have been really great. It hasn't necessarily, in terms of policy, been as transformative as people would like. He still has another year in his term. We'll see. But I think he's been right on in terms of CORE reform. I think there's been civil rights activists pushing him to do even more in terms of to invest in rehabilitation. And Jim was mentioning earlier recidivism. One of the biggest problems that we have is a hugely high recidivism rate. And what that means is a turnstile relationship with prison. Young black men go into prison, they go out, they come out of prison, and they go right back in. And that's strictly connected to lack of opportunity. Even young people without felony convictions, unemployment rates in inner cities for young black men 18 to 25 are as high as 45% and 50% in places like Chicago, Washington, D.C., New York City. It's very high in Boston. So that's the problem. The problem is a problem of unemployment and opportunity.
We're talking with Peniel Joseph. He's a history professor at Tufts University and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. So should we legalize all drugs?
No, but I think the what we should do in terms of marijuana and so-called soft drugs is really set up a context nationally where people are not going to be arrested for that, especially if
what's
they
the
have
a soft drug besides marijuana.
Well, sometimes people can say marijuana. Sometimes people can say I'm trying to think of a soft drug behind. I'm not
Molly.
I'm not,
that was very popular in all the nightclubs.
They're
doing that at Tufts University, Peniel.
No. I think we have good conscientious students
okay.
at Tufts.
Okay.
So I would say, especially marijuana, to make sure if people only have enough for their personal use that they are not entered into the system, because the system is overloaded and you know, we can see the harm that that's causing.
Yeah. I mean, they had the Mattapan massacre in Boston a few years ago when two guys, a woman and her young baby, were all killed.
Yep.
They were probably doing some other selling there, too, but they were primarily marijuana dealers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought that was incredible, murder over marijuana dealers. It just seemed crazy. And if it were legal, you'd have to be dealing cocaine, I guess, before you had that kind of carnage.
Is there another piece of the solution, Peniel Joseph, that is within the realm of possibility? I mean, the reality is even some very conservative people, either for libertarian reasons or budgetary reasons, are looking at easing some of the enforcement, at least, if not the laws themselves, around minor drug offenses. Is there another fix that is realistic that you, that Alexander, Michelle Alexander, would buy into?
Yeah, I mean, at the federal level, they've already done reforms to make sure that crack cocaine has gone down from the disparity between crack and powdered cocaine has gone down from 50 to 1 to 18 to 1. But making that 1 to 1 would be, at the federal level, one of the biggest things that you could do.
If Holder was sitting here and you said that to him, what would he say to you?
You know, I think he would say we can't necessarily get that passed through this Congress. So I would
but
say,
he'd agree with the notion, but say it's not real.
Yeah, I think he would agree with the notion. I think the other side would be, away from sequestration, it would be budgets. And I agree with Michelle Alexander in this sense that what we've done is we far exceeded the money for drug interdiction and enforcement than rehabilitation. So if we look at drug use as a public health problem, which, by the way, we did in the 1960s and 70s, and one of the best arguments that the new Jim Crow makes is that if you go back to 1982, right before the crack cocaine upsurge and the wars, you ask most Americans, was drugs a major problem in the United States? It didn't make the top 10. So what's interesting is that what we see is that drug use used to be an issue of health. It was public health.
Right.
Heroin. Cocaine. This was public health. Just like alcohol. If we turned the clock back and said this was a public health issue, we wouldn't have prisons bursting. We've gone from a United States of America that in 1980 had less than 400,000 total prisoners in the entire United States. We've gone from that 33 years later. We have almost 2 million people, five times the rate.
Staggering.
It's staggering.
You know, I just wonder, we had this congressman from Florida who got caught buying cocaine with the undercover officers. You know, and I was struck by the fact, number one, yeah, Trey Raydell, that he wanted tougher drug laws for everybody else. But when he's caught himself.
No, for food stamp recipients, he wanted tougher drug enforcement food stamps.
But when he was caught himself, he called his affliction a disease, and he said he believed in redemption and forgiveness. And no one, needless to say, is talking about any kind of prison sentence for him. Juxtaposition is fascinating.
No, this is outrageous. And we, at the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, Teresa Sullivan, who's our program coordinator, wrote an article in The Root about this congressman and how outrageous it was and how inconsistent it was. If he had been African-American, would the same outcomes have happened? And it wouldn't have. So part of what we see is that the racial disparities in the 21st century connected to the criminal justice system are about outcomes. If it smells like a duck, walks like a duck, it is a duck. And so when you see disparate outcomes, when you see all these young black men in prison, the prison population is about 50% African-American. They're only 12% of the population, 10-12% of the population. You know something's wrong. Something tragically is wrong. And what's great about Michelle Alexander, and she'll be at Tufts 7 p.m. It's 7 p.m.
It says 7:30 on the web, so it is definitely 7 o'clock.
7 p.m.
Great.
Yes, definitely
okay, great.
7 p.m. Is that she has written a clarion call for the 21st century. So many of my students, both white, Latino, Asian American, African American, have really held on to this book. They've attended teach-ins connected to the new Jim Crow. This is a 21st century issue. It goes beyond race, class, gender, sexuality. It connects to human rights. And I think the reason this has been a bestseller, over 79 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, is because people understand how important this is. We as a society are judged by how we treat the least of these. So Bertolt Brecht talked about it in terms of where does a just man go in an unjust society, finds himself in prison, right? And so this prisoner rights are the 21st century issue, civil rights issue of our time. And this issue of mass incarceration transcends race, class, gender, and sexuality.
You know, I just want to mention, I interviewed a guy last week for Thanksgiving. His name is Michael Griswold. He had been a drug addict, and he'd been homeless, and he was living under a bridge underneath 93. Got his life together after he had a son. And he's been sober now for a decade. And he cannot get a job. And when his last job, when they found out he had a record, he got fired. He's been looking for 2 years for work, and he's gotten his life together. And this is exactly what you're talking about. He can't survive and raise his children without employment. And doesn't matter that he's been sober. Doesn't matter. He's got people on his side. People don't want to hire him.
And we see our new mayor, you know, has battled the mayor-elect, has battled addictions.
That's right.
Been very outspoken about that, hasn't touched a drop in over two decades, and is now going to be mayor of this great city of Boston. So there is redemption. And I think the biggest problem we see with mass incarceration is this idea that these young black men or middle-aged or older black men cannot be given a second chance and get that redemption.
And they're stealing because of their drug problem, to get the money for the drugs. And once they stop doing the drugs, they don't need the money and they can live a decent life, but they don't get a second chance too many times.
Hey, Peniel Joseph, good to see you.
Great to be
here. Tomorrow night sounds
always
great. Looking forward to it.
Thank you very much for being here, Peniel. History professor at Tufts, I should say Peniel Joseph, is a history professor at Tufts and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. And tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, not 7:30, Tufts is hosting civil rights lawyer Michelle Alexander. It's her book. We've been talking about. That book is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. You want to get more information? Go to tufts.edu. When we come back, Edgar B. Hurwicke III and Boston Globe pop music and TV critic Sarah Rodman join us to go over new music. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We were just having a cash conversation with our friends here.
People miss out on the best part of the show, which is the breaks. I mean, it is so fun in here for that.
Actually, it wasn't that much fun, but I know what you mean. That is the voice, by the way, of Edgar B. Hurwicke III. He's the person on top of or behind the GBH Curiosity Desk.
Often underneath.
Also in here. That's between you and the desk, I think. Here with us also is Sarah Rodman. Sarah's the pop music and TV critic, of course, for the Boston Globe. Great to see both you guys.
Hello.
Happy to be here.
We love, by the way, I love this segment. Marjorie really loves this segment.
Because,
when she hears the two of you are coming, she is in ecstasy.
I'm a loser, okay, when it comes to music. And, you know, I feel as though I can impress my friends. My iPod is sounding better. My children don't think I'm as pathetic as I used to be because I, of course, can import all these songs onto my little iPad. I finally figured out how to do it. iPod, that is. And, you know, I feel
you can put them on your iPad,
we're here for you, Marjorie.
You can put them on
your
iPad.
Okay,
Sarah.
I can.
Yeah,
no,
you can.
Your iPad, that's
I'll
right.
show you how to
you
do
can.
That. You can.
Great.
Okay,
technology.
Sarah Rodman, why
yes,
don't
sir.
You start us off this particular
All right.
week?
I will start us off with a song from my favorite album title of the year. This album is called Good Wine and Bad Decisions.
Oh, I love it.
It's so
great.
Good. And this is an artist named Julie Roberts. She's a country singer who sort of had it happening in the early aughts, but then it wasn't really working for her. And then earlier this year, she actually went on The Voice, and she didn't get anybody to turn around, which is amazing because she's really great. So she went to Memphis to Sun Studios and put out a new record. And this song is called He Made a Woman Out of Me.
Wow.
All right.
A little bit south of Montgomery.
Oh.
Mama worked in the big house. Daddy, he worked for the county. Never had no learning till I turned 16. When Joe Henry come up the river, y'all, Lord, he made a woman out of me.
That is unbelievable.
Oh,
by the way,
so
you are the only person who has used the aughts in a sentence with like no pretense. It just came out there.
Natural.
The early aughts. It was great.
Do people not say that? Is that
I've never heard it before. I love it. I mean, that is the term. Oh, so what's okay. Where is this? I am embarrassed to say I never heard of her. What's her?
So she's so great, and she just sort of got lost in that shuffle of there was sort of a group of people that came out at that time, and she didn't have, you know, a great big hit song. And so she ended up getting dropped from her label. But then Sun came to the rescue. And if this is not sort of a Dusty in Memphis revisited, so sexy, the whole album is really sultry and smoky. And,
great.
I mean, it's country music, but it's also R&B and blues. And this is a woman who has lived. There's a great song on here called Gasoline and Matches, which is all about how sort of the combustive relations.
Intense.
Yes, it's really, really
That's
good.
Why you love country music, though. Everybody's always, you know, the gun rack and the beers and too many beers. And
and my daddy left me and my grandpa stepped on me and all these disasters. You know, yes. I just love
a good disaster can be a good time, especially this time of year.
So can you top that, Edgar B. Herrick III?
No, we know this is what happens. Sarah comes out of the gate. It's not a competition
that
Sarah,
I am winning.
Not a competition that Sarah always wins. Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm going to start off with a new record called Harlem River. This is by a guy named Kevin Morby. He's a little bit of a nomad in the indie rock world. He's played with a couple of bands out of Brooklyn, one called The Woods and one called The Babies, or I should say Woods and The Babies. And they both had sort of moderate levels of success, you know, within their certain genres. But he's kind of struck out on his own now, and he's put out a solo record. It's a really good record. It's actually generally a pretty quiet record. It's a pretty pensive record. A lot of acoustic guitars, a lot of guitar playing and sort of electronics and organ sound. And he's drawn really from kind of updating to some extent and on another level kind of mimicking the sound of somebody like a Lou Reed, Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen. You hear a little bit of that in it. But you also hear some of the people like who are around now, like a Kurt Vile, with a little bit of the atmospherics. This track is called Wild Side, Oh, the Places You'll Go. Here's a little taste of this. You'll definitely hear the Bob Dylan influence here.
Let the sun come up, let the sun rise. As it rips the curtain of your eye. Oh, my lover, is it always the same? With your pointing your finger, the way back I came. Oh, my lover, you never call my bluff again. What you had now, but it was never enough, never enough. And all the places you go.
You know, I like it a lot.
Yeah.
But because the deal, is he trying to be Dylan, or
This one. I mean, I picked this track because it's definitely the most upbeat for a segment like this. If you're just going to listen to it, and that's the one where he's sort of mostly on the nose with Dylan with that. Especially you hear that like organ behind him, which is so reminiscent of like the Blonde on Blonde era Dylan. The rest of the record, he doesn't really sound as much like Bob Dylan. He's definitely not doing past. He's probably a little bit better of a singer than Bob Dylan is, but there's definitely a strong influence there. Less so through the rest of the record, though.
What's the name of the guy, speaking of organ, the most famous organ riff?
Al Cooper.
Al Cooper, a Somervillian, right? Former front man for Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and one of the greats. He was on virtually every big song ever done by anybody. He's unbelievable.
That, like, Rolling Stone thing.
Oh, man. Yeah. It is unbelievable.
Classic.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'd say you did pretty well for yourself.
It was okay.
You did quite well. I mean, he's no Julie Roberts, but he was. So can you raise your game even more, Sarah Robin?
I believe I can.
Okay, we shall see, won't we?
But really, it's in the hands of Nora Jones and Billy Joe Armstrong, because this is a very, I mean, talk about an odd couple, right? This is this sort of honey-voiced chanteuse and the lead singer of Green Day getting together to make a tribute album to the Everly Brothers.
They are also known, by the way, as Good Wine and Bad Decisions.
Right, exactly. That is how this happened at the Everly. But it actually ended up being Good Wine and Good Decisions, because the album, which is called For Everly, it's not the Wake Up Little Susie, Bye Bye Love. It's not the popular songs. It's actually almost a track-by-track remake of Everly Brothers' album called Songs My Father Taught Me that came out in 1958. And it's a lot of sort of traditional country, traditional folk music. And this song, which is my favorite song on the record, because I'm a sucker for this kind of song, it's about a little boy on a train who doesn't have the money to pay for the train ride. And then they find out it's because he's on his way home to his mother's funeral.
Oh my God.
It's called Lightning Express, Revel in the Sadness.
The Lightning Express from the depot so grand. And started out on its way. All of the passengers that were on board.
was reading a letter he had. You could plainly tell by the look on his face that the contents of it made him sad.
Because his mother's dead.
You know,
is there anything funnier than death?
It's a riot. It's a riot. The duets, though, I love duets.
I think
like
in a
this.
Blind taste test, most people would not recognize that voice as Billy Joe Armstrong's voice.
You know, would you be shocked if I told you I actually saw Green Day at Gillette? I mean, it's
really?
Pretty, I know.
Shocked that you went to Gillette.
I know. Well, it's the only stadium concert I've ever seen. He was unbelievable. And now I can't. You know what? I can't get out of, I love Norah Jones. Mm-hmm. I can't get out of my head her performance in Ted. I mean, the fact that she was dead
is
just so weird. What did you think of that song?
I thought it was terrific. I think
they sound really, really good.
You know, it's funny. When I was in high school, and that's kind of – Green Day hit the scene when I was in high school. And, you know, my mother's a big music person. And, you know, a lot of stuff I listened to was the stuff that she was into. But in high school, that was like the time when our taste probably diverged the most. And a lot of the stuff that I was listening to, that early grunge stuff, she wasn't really into. But it was funny with Green Day, even right out of the gate. My mom always would say, she goes, "That guy can really sing." That was her. Yeah. That was her thing about Billy Joe from the beginning. She's like, "He can really, really sing." And you hear it in this. And to your point, you're right. You hear that, and you're not necessarily going to peg that as him. I think he sort of sings in character a little bit with Green Day,
yes. I think
you can kind of hear that
on this too.
And but somebody that can do that, that shows some versatility. And he is. He's a really good singer. And that, and on a track like that, it really works.
Now, excuse me for 1 second. Mm-hmm. So not all of us have seen Ted. Yes. Was Norah Jones good or not good?
She played herself, and she was fine, right?
But as having had a sexual liaison with Ted the teddy bear. She does. I mean, does she not? That is, why are you looking like that, Sarah? That's what Ted is talking about, how when they
upsetting.
Had a night. Exactly. It is upsetting. But.
Teddy and Norah. Wow. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you got over there, Edgar B. Hurwitz III?
Well, I'm gonna stick with this sort of sadder theme. I'm gonna go with probably the most melancholy song I have on my list, and I'm actually excited to do this because I have lost all perspective on this woman. This is a woman named Kate Le Bon, right? She comes from Wales. And I have become so enraptured with her mystical, strange-sounding voice that I have lost any perspective on whether this music is good or not because I have fallen completely under its spell. I'm totally gone on this. So she has a new record out called Mug Museum. Now, she's an interesting case because her first album she recorded in Welsh. It was all songs sung in her native tongue of Welsh, which, as you guys know, sort of sounds like the elfish language from, like, you know, Lord of the Rings. It's sort of mystical and magical. But, she definitely, when you hear her, a lot of people will compare her to Nico from the Velvet Underground. She has this kind of very haunting voice. You'll also hear stuff like, you know, kind of Jefferson Airplane or Donovan. It's kind of psychedelic and folksy at the same time. This track in particular, sort of also is a little bit of a nod to French girl singers of the 60s and stuff like that. This is called I Think I Knew from her new record, Mug Museum. I'm interested to hear what you guys think of this.
There's no working it out.
I do prefer the original Welsh, I have to say. Shit, that is haunting
like
and great.
Right?
Singing Nun. Reminds me a little bit of that Madeline Combat in Blazing Saddles. I'm so tired.
No, it's true, but listen, she's saying things like there's no boundary to devotion. Like, and it's lost in it. It's beautiful.
What's with you and the Donovan and Jefferson Airplane and Bob Dylan? I mean, what's going on? Is there some? I mean, there's a thread through these things.
Is that stuff not great?
No, is Donovan alive, by the way?
Yes, he is.
He doesn't do anything anymore, does he?
No, he still puts records out.
He does?
Yeah, absolutely.
He looks good, too.
Yeah, he does. And the stuff he puts out now, I would argue, is not quite as good as what he was doing through the 60s and 70s, but. It it's still very good. And he, you know, he put a weird record out maybe about 10 years ago where it was called Sueños, right? And it was all stuff that he had. He was like, all of this music came to me in dreams. It's all stuff that I found in my dreams.
It's
sort of like after years and years of being Donovan, that's what happens, I guess. But
right. I'm sure his dreams are right. But I like that, although no relation to Simon Le Bon from Duran Duran.
No relation to Simon Le Bon at all. And the rest of that record is not quite as sort of melancholy or slow as that is. And she can really, you know, she's got a really good guitar player who plays with her, can be really kind of big and rocking at times, psychedelic. It's good. It's a very good record.
Now, Sarah, I'm told your next selection talks about someone who goes home and their whole family has been taken out by... is that the next
it's
one on
all
the list?
Over. It just gets worse and worse and worse.
What's next on your list?
Actually, next, Kate Le Mon might think she knew, but Matthew Sweet and Susanna Hoffs, they don't know. This is actually a cover of a cover. Kirsty MacColl did the song originally, and then Tracy Ullman actually had sort of a hit with it in the 80s. And this Matthew Sweet and Susanna Hoffs, who's the lead singer of the Bangles, have been doing this series of albums called Under the Covers, where they do covers albums. And this one is devoted to the 80s. And the great thing about this record is that even though it's all different songs from all different artists, the Smiths, Tracy Ullman, it actually has a very sort of cohesive tone to it, like they make it their own thing. And this is just sort of a fun song. So this is They Don't Know.
You've been around for such a long time now. Maybe I could leave you, but I don't know how. And why should I be lonely every night when I could be with you? Oh, yes, you make it right, and I don't listen to the guys who say that you're bad for me.
It's fun, right?
It's great.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like a retro girl group, layer cake harmony kind of thing. And the whole record is, it's a lot of the record is more rockin' than that is. But that's just a really sort of enjoyable, frothy sound that they get.
That's one of my favorite songs. That Kirsty MacColl version of that song, the original version, is one of my absolute favorite songs. It's a great karaoke song.
Yes.
It's another good thing about it. But now, Sarah, it occurs to me, now this song sounds like it's without tragedy, but how did Kirsty MacColl die?
Oh, God, it's so sad.
Tell us how the artist who did this song originally, how did she die?
God bless her heart. She was on vacation in Mexico with her children, actually. It is a very sad story. And they were playing in the water, and she got hit by people on a jet ski, and it killed her. And her kids were there. It's awful.
Oh, that is horrible.
Just awful. And she was a terrific artist. You may also know her from the Pogues Fairy Tale in New York. She's the female voice on that, which is a popular holiday song that the Pogues do.
The unofficial or even official Christmas carol of Ireland.
Yes, and she was married to Steve Lillywhite, who's famous for producing records for U2 and the Dave Matthews Band and a whole bunch of people over the years. Yeah, that was a very sad story.
How old
she was probably only in her 40s, late 40s, early 50s.
Great artist, great singer.
But,
thanks for bringing that up,
terrific
Edgar.
Song.
Okay.
Thanks, Edgar.
What do you bring on the table now?
Let's bring it back up with some music. So this is a burgeoning very good story. This is an artist named Jake Bugg. Now he comes from Nottingham, in England, and he grew up in what's basically the largest housing project in all of England. So he comes from this like really tough background. He's got this, you know, sort of great story about when he was a kid. He heard Starry, Starry Night by Don McLean. You guys know that song, Starry, Starry Night?
Absolutely.
Of course, right? So he heard that on an episode of The Simpsons.
About Vincent van Gogh, obviously. Right,
So he hears this on an episode of The Simpsons, and he sort of, it's one of these like life-changing moments. He's like 12 or 13 years old. His uncle buys him a guitar, and he gets obsessed with music and starts to write music, listen to music. He starts to really get into... To bring up what you were talking about earlier, people like Johnny Cash, the Everly Brothers, this kind of early American stuff. So he put a record out. He's still only 19. He put a record out last year, I guess, when he was 18, which got big thumbs up from a lot of critics, especially in England. And then he traveled around through the American South over the last year, and he teamed up with Rick Rubin here in America, who recruited some people that had played with Elvis Costello, as well as Chad Smith from the Red Hot Chili Peppers to play drums for this second record, which just came out. And this kid is young. This is not a perfect record, but he's young. His lyrics are great. He's got a lot of energy. And it's weird because he's also this big Oasis fan. So you'll hear this sort of sound. You can hear that he's British and this kind of like sound of Oasis on top of this kind of American, kind of early Americana rock and roll kind of thing. He's still kind of forming, I think, as an artist, but this record is really good, and he's definitely somebody to keep your eye on. So this is a tune called There's a Beast and We All Feed It, Jake Bugg.
They can't eat it. Think about they don't speak it. There's a beast eating every bit of beauty and they all feed it. Stop, moment, try to freeze it. They find they don't seek it. At the bar, but they can't meet it. Try the best, but they can't eat it. Nice call, somebody keys it. There's a beast eating every bit of beauty and you stay feed it.
Sounds he a little sounds bit like a bug, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah. But he sounds like somebody else. Who does he sound like?
He sounds like Liam Gallagher from Oasis to me.
His Dylan impression.
Yeah. A little bit.
Hey, you guys, we only have 2 minutes left, so we got to move on to a quick one from each of you.
All right. This is my quick one from Butch Walker, one of my very favorite people, who sadly his father passed away this year.
Is that really true or not?
That's really true. And he put out an EP called Peachtree Battle that was a little bit inspired by the elder Butch. And great artist who's worked with Keith Urban, Taylor Swift, Pink, Katy Perry. He's one of these producer-songwriter for hire for other people, but then he makes his own records that are just these incredible, beautiful, power pop, thoughtful, lyrical, great records. And the song is called Coming Home.
You're just another guy more than halfway.
You guys have really hit it today.
Yeah, these are great. My iPod is going to be so cool. I just won't be able to stand it.
So, Edgar, we have 45 seconds. We're going to go out on your song, actually. So give it to us.
So this is the Arcade Fire, who won a Grammy for their last record.
Sarah was applauding, by the way.
And then they just took a huge, bold step with this new record. They teamed up with a guy named James Murphy from a band called LCD Sound System, which really kind of gives them a little bit of a different flavor and a different sound. One of the artists in this band, her parents are from Haiti. And she took a trip to Haiti along with the band. It was their first time ever there. And this record is largely inspired by their experiences down in Haiti and what's going on there. Great, great record. Took a couple listens for me to come around, but I have come around. This is a big thumbs up from me.
We want to thank Sarah Rodman from the Boston Globe. Sarah, it's great to see you,
as always. Thank you, Sarah, for coming in.
Our colleague, WGBH's Edgar B. Herwick III. You guys were great, as always. We can't wait till next time. We'll be back in a second, so do not go away.
We want to tell you that all the music you just heard from Sarah and Edgar is on our website at WGBH, so check that out. Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to be joined by Doris Kearns Goodwin, her great new book about Theodore Roosevelt. Also, open mic with Alex Beam. Doris's good book is called The Bully Pulpit, I should say. Our show is a production of WGBH. Thanks to Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. Thanks to you, Jim Browdy. I don't know what I'd do without you here to correct me.
Well, I feel exactly the same way. I mean, thanking you. I'm Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you tune in again tomorrow.